Southeast Linux Fest is a community event for anyone who wants to learn more about Linux and free and open source software. It is part educational conference and part social gathering. Like Linux itself, it is shared with the attendees of all skill levels to communicate tips and ideas and to benefit all who use Linux and free and open source software. The Linux Fest is a place to learn, to make new friends, to network with new business partners, and most importantly, to have fun. Come join us for the first annual Southeast Linux Fest on June 13th, 2009 in Clemson, South Carolina. Register today at southeastlinuxfest.org.
Welcome to the Upstate Carolina Linux User Group Podcast.
Shall we?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, hey, y'all. Welcome to the Upstate Carolina Linux User Group. My name is Jace. You can call me Jace. Just call me Jace. Today is, let me get to for recording purposes, May 12th, 2009. And what? So today we have Mike Major giving us a newbie session on GNU Cache. And then later on, our fearless leader, Rick Smith, will be giving us a little presentation on the Google phone. A lightning talk? Oh no! Well, it's a Mac.
I got it working.
Oh, you got Linux on Mac? Well, see, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So, without further ado, Mike, if you'll take it away.
You want to start that, or do you want to do like?
We'll do
yourself
it.
Or anything first?
We'll do that in a minute.
Okay. We'll break it up.
Okay. Once again, I'm Mike Major, and earlier in the year we had talked about, well, what do we want to know about this year? We made a big long list. And Jace said, well, what do you want to know? And I said, I want to know about GNU Cache, or GNU Cache as it's called, I guess. Does anybody know about it? Nobody raised their hand, so I got to volunteer for it. So I spent the last several months working with GNU Cache, trying to figure it out, essentially because of my mom, who's right there. She's still in the Windows world, and of course, probably if you know about Linux, you know there's a couple things that hold it back. And cache management's one of them. So if I can get her convinced, then she'll come over to the Linux world with us. So that's why I've done this. As you can see, it's not going to be in-depth. It's a newbie session. And of course, I can't go in-depth anyway because I don't know a lot about it. I am using version 227. This talk is going to be geared more towards the personal user, as opposed to the business user. But GNU Cache will do business functions as well. We'll talk a little bit about that. Like I said, it's not going to be an in-depth exploration of installation or customization or anything like that. We're going to talk about these things. Double entry accounting and what it means, split transactions, transaction importing and matching, load manager and scheduled transactions, budgeting and reports, online transaction support, and touch lightly on business topics. So that's a preview of what's to come. So double entry accounting, what does that mean? If you're an accountant like my mom, you know what that means. Maybe we should have her explain it. It doesn't work. It doesn't want to go to presentation mode for some reason. Double entry accounting means there's always two accounts involved. The money's got to come from some account, and it's got to go to another account. So, for example, your paycheck comes from an account called income salary. Or you can set it up for, I work for company XYZ, you can say income company XYZ. And it goes to assets checking, or whatever you want to set it up to be. And then by the same token, payments go out, like from your electric bill goes out from checking to expenses, utilities, electric. And you can set all these categories up to be anything you want them to be. But what's kind of nice about GNU Cache is it comes pre-configured with several charts of accounts. And that's accountant speak for where you want to put all your money, how you want to categorize it. It's called a chart of accounts. So you've got income, you've got expenses, you've got liabilities, you've got loans, whatever you want to, how deep you want to get. So you can start out with a checkbook. If you don't want to get your feet wet with too much else, you can add in education, car, mortgage loans, homeowner's expenses like utilities, investments, CDs, money markets, spouse income. If your spouse works, then you can have an account that says income primary, income spouse. Business accounts. And then I was working with the portable apps version of this at work today at lunch, and it looked okay on the Windows side, but coming over here, it's a little bit different. So that's why some of the formatting looks a little weird. But additional accounts can be added later. So if you just start out with a checking account and you say, you know what, I like this a lot, I'm going to keep going. I want to add all my household accounts, things like that, then just start typing away, add them in later. It's no problem. This is a screenshot of the first setup screen. You set up an account. So common accounts is pretty much what everybody gets. You get assets, equity, expenses. If you have CDs and money market, all you do is you get the checkbox and you get that one too. I really wanted to try and find a way that if you start out without a child, like me, and then you have a child later, it'd be nice if you could go back and just say, well, I want to add the child care set of accounts, but I never could find a way to do that. Maybe there's a way, I don't know, but I wasn't successful. Split transactions. We talked about your paycheck earlier. To be really honest and detailed about it, your paycheck doesn't just come from income and go to checking. It comes from your company, and some of it goes to federal withholding. That's what you pay your taxes with. Goes to Social Security, goes to state withholding, maybe it goes to 401k if you got that, and then what's left over goes to checking. So a split transaction is you get income and then it goes to many different accounts. I just thought of it this morning. I don't know if you could have a split transaction where you have multiple incomes coming to the same destination account. I don't know if that would even make sense. My accountant mom is saying no, so I'm going to go with her. And this is a screenshot of what a split transaction might look like. So you might make $1,000 in salary, but you only get $900 in your checking account because $33 of it goes to taxes, $10 goes to Social Security, so on and so forth. I think you probably get the idea. You've been around long enough. You know what's going on. Transaction importing, that's a fairly big deal. We all want, everything's computerized today, so why can't we just make it as easy as possible? Transactions can be imported into GNU Cash, just like everything else. The two big formats are OFX, Open Finance Exchange, which was, it's actually proprietary, and you have to pay, companies pay license to use that format to Quicken or Intuit. And QIF is the Quicken Interchange format. It's an open format. It's the predecessor to OFX. It's non-licensed. But there's some issues around that which causes them to create the OFX version, like if you're dealing with multiple currencies or something like that, if you've got a business and you're selling stuff in euros, QIF doesn't really allow you to say, this transaction is in euros, but the next transaction is in dollars, and the next one is in Chinese, whatever they use, yuan or something, right? Something like that. So that's why OFX is used, and it's pretty much the main one nowadays. When you import transactions, if you're using GNU Cash every day and you're typing stuff in, or just so you don't forget, it will match transactions if they already exist. So when you bring something in and you've already entered in your $24 Walmart purchase because you just were so happy that you went to Walmart and you had to have it down, it'll find that transaction. The parameters for matching are customizable. So if you say, if it gets within a dollar in a day, that's close enough to match it up. Or if you want to be spot on, you say you got to be within a penny and you got to be within, maybe, I don't know if you can go less than a day. That even really makes sense. But you can customize those parameters. And the big thing really, like if you're in the Windows world or if you're using another software package, you can export your current system in either QIF or OFX. and then you can import that into GNU Cash, and it will bring with it all of your existing categories or accounts, something like that. So that's where I got started. Really, I had Money7. I didn't really use it, but export from Money7 in OFX, bring it into GNU Cash, and maybe you've got an expense for your Snapper lawnmower, and that's probably not one of the normal accounts that come set up. It'll say, oh, is this a new account? Do you want to set it up? And you can say, yeah. Or you can probably map that to a different account. So that's really the big deal on transaction importing. And a screenshot of that. So you can see right here, Walmart Supercenter. We got really happy. When it went home, had already typed in our Walmart expense for $17.99 on 324. And when we went to the bank, I bank with Bank of America. You can go to their website and get any list of transactions you want in OFX format, and you can see that it matched that transaction already, so it won't duplicate that transaction or double dip, however you want to think about it. Mortgage loans. I was pretty happy about how it handles mortgage loans. I think we still got a little bit of work to do here, but overall it works quite well. You put in the loan amount, obviously, when the loan started, the term of the loan, the interest rate, that sort of thing, and it'll automate your amortization. So every month it'll get the interest and the principal portion correct. It handles adjustable rate mortgages, it handles fixed rate mortgages. So if you have a 5-1 ARM, you can put in, it's a 5-1 ARM, and it resets every June for the next year, it'll do that. It'll handle it. It'll ask you if you want to use escrow accounts for taxes, insurance, private mortgage insurance, things like that. And then if you use the scheduled transactions, it'll pop up and say, ah, you should have made your house payment by now. And it'll pop it up and it will say, and you can review it. So there's a screenshot of setting up the loan information. Here's the loan account, so it's under loans. Mortgage loan is just real simple. It could be anything you want. If you've got multiple properties, you can have multiple property names up there. There's your amount, your interest rate. If it's fixed rate or adjustable, whatever, start, term, length in years or months, and then it'll tell you how many years or months are remaining. That's where you could choose to use an escrow account. I didn't get real deep with that, but it does do it. And of course, if you check those boxes, then it says, well, what account is your tax account? Which account is your PMI account? That sort of thing. Here's the screenshot of the amortization. So I didn't find where they documented that that formula there. So if you wanted to use it somewhere else, they probably do. But it says, okay, you want to make payments for this loan out of what account? Pay the principal to this account, the interest to this account. How often do you make your payment? Is it on a biweekly status or a monthly status? What do? Do you pay every week? Some people pay twice a month to cut down on their principal, that sort of thing. And then when you're done, it says, well, here's your amortization schedule for the next so many periods, which I think is pretty nice. Scheduled transactions are similar to the loan. If you want to go ahead and set up, well, I got a Discover magazine subscription and I pay them $3 every month or whatever. You can enter that in and it'll enter that in for you as many times as you want. Typically, when you start the program, let me swap over to your desktop. That's just a little, you can see a little UC log play area I created. It wants to create the loan payment that we saw amortized, and then also the satellite TV. So I start up the software. It says, oh, you've got scheduled transactions. If you want to, you can review them before you accept them, or you can just accept them straight in. I think that's pretty nice. They can have any multiple frequencies, daily, weekly, monthly, every 2 weeks, every 3 months, every 7 days, every 2 days, whatever you want to do. From any account to any account, they can have splits, anything you can do, it can be a scheduled transaction as well. There's a screenshot of what I just showed you on the other desk.
Question for you.
Yeah.
Is it actually doing them, or is it just telling you you need to go and do them?
That's in online transaction support. Some financial institutions support that, and we'll see that in a couple seconds.
It doesn't. It doesn't, yeah.
Yeah. With
but
budgeting...
It's only going to be if it's a something that supports an online transaction.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's just like a reminder that you need to write your check.
Yeah.
But it does the entry for you.
But it will also export, if your institution supports it, it will export an OFX to your institution that says, debit this account and send it to these people. Budgeting. I'm just now getting started with the budgets. You can enter budgets by category. Maybe you want to be very detailed. Maybe you want to be very sparse with your information. You can use it also if you're in a business. I saw a lot of discussions on the internet about, are we talking capital budgeting? Or are we talking just checkbook budgeting? What are we talking about here? Capital expenditures over the next three-year business plan, something like that? Or what? It'll handle both. You can tell it to use historical transactions. So if you've got a bunch of data in there from last year and you say, well, our electric bill goes high in the summer and it goes down in the winter because we have gas heat, you can tell it, pull in starting from January of last year, or actually this is May, tell it, starting from May of last year, plop in what I paid last month, or last year in this month, to this year this month, and the same thing. So it'll carry on out for you. I think that's pretty nice. And then it provides a standard report for you to compare your actual spending versus your budget spending. Now we get to online transactions. It does support online transactions. For OFX importing directly from many institutions. I tried Bank of America. I didn't get it to work yet. It's probably something in the setup because other people claim they've gotten it to work. It claims to work with Scottrade and Discover Credit Card and others. I have a Discover card and I did get it to work with Discover. It imported all my transactions from like a year and a half ago. Everything they had, it brought in, which was pretty cool. I don't use my Discover card a lot, so it's not a lot of typing, but still. Once it gives you those transactions, it will remember, oh, he's already got those, and I go back and get more, and it'll say, give me the ones that I don't have. Some institutions do charge for this. Bank of America charges for it, unless you have a certain kind of account. I happen to have that certain kind of account, but you do have to keep minimums and that sort of thing, and we fell under a minimum once, and they charge you $10 for it. They call it Quicken Support. But the only problem is if you call them up and they say, well, what software are you running? And you tell them, well, just don't worry about it because you don't know what it is. Are you running money? No. Are you running Quicken? No. Well, what are you running? Linux. Okay, bye. So that's okay. I mean, we like Linux, so we like getting the details and figuring out on our own. There's a pretty good website that GNUcash maintains on setting up OFX Direct. They've got all the bank codes for a lot of institutions, including Discover Card, Bank of America, some pretty obscure banks out in like New Jersey, whatever, credit cards, Scottrade, whatever. Just go to that website, and it'll help you set up your transactions online. There are quite a few standard reports that are set up, but in my experience, standard reports don't really do what you want to do. I haven't really used a lot of the reporting other than tax time. Really, the only time I ever use this is at tax time. At the end of the year, I want to run the tax report and say, tell me everything that's tax-related. And you can do that. Every account that you set up, it has a little flag that says tax-related. And if you flag that, you can run a report. It'll tell you, you gave these charity donations, you spent this much in interest, you improved your rental property for $2,500, all those things so that you can take them on your taxes. Including, obviously, federal and state withholding. On the business side, it handles customers, suppliers, employees, invoicing, and payments. We have a little side business. I'd actually thought about trying to make an invoice in here. But I don't know what it would do if you made an invoice for someone who hadn't actually ordered something. It was just essentially a quotation. So I didn't try it yet. So I'm kind of still trying to get my feet wet here as well. So that's GNUcash in 20 minutes probably. 25. Any questions? guess not.
Can you demo it a little bit? Just drive around for a little bit?
Yeah.
Can you turn off the double entry stuff?
No. Why would you want to do that?
Because it makes my head hurt. I mean, I tried GNU Cash. I tried K Money Dance. I mean, not money, K My Money or whatever it's called. I tried them all, but
yeah.
I ended up settling on Money Dance, which is slightly proprietary. They've open sourced some plugins, but it's $29, and it's more like Quicken. It's more for dummies like me. It's none of this double entry stuff that I don't understand. I tried that, and I couldn't do it.
It is a little bit, it takes some getting used to, but once you get it working, I like it. Because you can use, it makes you account for everything. There's no fudging stuff.
I think the benefit of the idea behind the double entry is then everything balances out. It comes from one place and it goes to another.
Right.
So if you go down to the bottom line and sum it all up, it's got a sum to zero. Something comes in and it goes out some other place. And that's why it's done that way. It's an easy way for the accountants to make sure that you got everything right.
Yeah.
It may be something I misunderstood too. I may think it required me to do double entry.
The thing about this is it takes, when you put in a transaction, it takes care of both sides of that.
Yeah.
So if you pay for something with a credit card, it's going to mark it on your credit card account and against whatever, you know, budget item you've got.
Yeah.
So if it's gas, then you can keep track of how much you're spending on gas, and then when you pay your credit card, it's going to take it out of your check. It'll subtract from your checking and add it back in so that your credit card balance comes up to zero. So that way it keeps.
And you really need to understand like debits and credits, because a debit is not always a down. And one thing I found in here that I don't like is sometimes it depends on what kind of account you're talking about. If you talk about your checking account, it'll be an increase or a decrease. If you're talking about a loan, it's like they use other terminology. If you're talking about another kind of account, like an equity account, it's different terminology. So I'm forever being confused about which column the number should go in, and that is difficult to understand.
Well, I'm just a checking and savings kind of guy.
Yeah.
Money dance suits money.
The problem is that you have, if I go to dinner tonight and I charge Indigo Joe's on my credit card,
hey,
if I'm
anyone else.
Yes. So if I charge it on my credit card, then one of two things happens. Either it looks like I paid $20, and then I have this separate expense called paying my credit card bill, which isn't there, and that's one of the things double entry accounting helps with. Or it looks like I'm just tossing gobs of money at my credit card bill, and I'm not seeing that I'm spending 30% of my money on
food. You have to then get the transactions to make your credit card current. Because that's what I did. I brought in everything that was just related to the checking account. I didn't account for everything that was in the credit card. So my credit card looked like they owed me about $7,000, when they really didn't. I just hadn't entered all those transactions in yet.
Right.
And it would come from checking to go to the credit card, and it would bring that to zero, hopefully. And then you'd have the associate transaction for dinner from the credit card to the dining establishment.
Right.
So if we review the transactions that it wanted to create for the loan, it says the principal should be $388.08 for this fictitious loan. The interest is $385.75, and our total payment was $777.83. Nice. And then, of course, our satellite TV. And again, here, they're using total funds in, total funds out.
Scroll a little more.
There you go. Just right.
So, like I said, it's total funds in, total funds out here. Whereas if you look at the checking account, they're talking deposit and withdrawal. And to me, that gets a little confusing, so you kind of got to just look at what's going on. You can show splits on any transaction you want. You can have it always show splits for whatever transaction you're on. It will do double line is how you put in a note. Let me turn off that split because it's a little confusing. But if you want to say artistic cutters, oops, that mouse.
Where is it?
So here's your note. For PetSmart, the note came in because it was an imported transaction, OFS, whatever. You'd say, well, that was for the cat declawing or whatever. And it'll save that. You can duplicate transactions, which sometimes comes in nice if you make a mistake on something and it's a big long split and there's only one thing that's wrong, whatever, you can duplicate it, change the date, whatever. That's really nice. If you're looking here, like in PetSmart, it goes to miscellaneous. You can hit jump and it'll jump over to miscellaneous, which is nice. You can toggle back and forth. The accounts, as we have them set up here, we have assets, equity, expenses, and that's where most people add their stuff. If you want to look at, like, maybe under insurance, like health insurance is probably a good one to look at if you want to edit your account. We have an HSA, so that, for us, is tax-related. So if I hit tax-related, that'll show up on my tax report at the end of the year. So if I go into health insurance and just make a transaction real fast of blah from, and this is really nice too, if you just start typing the category, it'll pop up assets and you say colon, current assets, and you go down, it's from checking, and let's say we spent $78. So now at the end of the year, you do your tax report, it says, oh, remember that $78 you spent on health insurance? Well, don't forget to take that into account on your taxes. So that's kind of nice. I like that. Somehow, I missed reporting in here. Well, I guess the only thing I want to say about reporting is you can customize reports if you know Scheme. I've not run across Scheme before, but probably other people have. It sounds like it's fairly well known. I don't know. I don't use a lot of the reports because typically the one-size-fits-all report doesn't fit exactly what I want it to do. But like I said, I'm not a power user yet.
Now, when you start out, how do you start out? I mean,
you could say
put zeros and everything. And
you say file, new file. It's got a wizard. It helps you. You're good deal.
Do you look at your current bank statement and put that number in, or?
That's, I think, another part of the issue where you might get screwed up. It's like, if you just pick a date, January 1st, 2007, you start importing all your transactions from there, your bank account wasn't zero on January 1st. Right. It had some kind of a balance in it. I think there is an account, I know there is an account, that is, has something to do with equity opening balances. So I just kind of treated that as a trash account. If I needed to have a trash account, so everything that I need an opening balance for, like my car loan probably started maybe in 2000 and it's going on until who knows when because we keep refinancing, whatever. It needs to have an opening balance on it. So I've just thrown a whole bunch of opening balances in here. So if you say checking account, assets, checking account, and again, see, you see it here, increase, decrease. It drives me crazy. So I don't really know where to put it to say that my checking account had 1789.56 when it started. And you could pick the date on when you wanted that. Maybe it's January 1st of this year.
So that was just your way of working around a starting point.
Yeah, you got to start somewhere. And from the name of the account, opening balances, I took it to mean that's what this is for. It's just kind of a trash account. Do you agree with that, accountant mother?
So this account was never balanced.
Well, it's just for a thing.
Right.
You just want to, when you go to the next, it's just for a thing.
Right.
It's just for a thing.
I've tried to use this a while back, and I worked on it for maybe an hour, so I realized it's not very long. But I was able to import stuff from our, you know, checking account from the bank and all that stuff, but I could never figure out what to do with it. How do you start? You know, we don't have anything to import from that's already set up.
Yeah.
And like I said, I brought all that stuff in, and I started at zero.
You just start entering transactions.
Now you owe everyone money.
As you go along.
I think the easiest thing for someone who's not an accountant is to do what you did, which is to choose one of those chart accounts. But they have several sensors in the front line.
Yes.
I haven't set my chart accounts up yet. I'm waiting for you to get it for money. Well, because I don't have money, and I do,
like that.
But, when you go to set it up, basically, you choose a sample chart account.
Yeah. Like,
you pick out one that fits your best needs to start with, and say, this is my asset account to buy my business account to buy a company. So that when you import from your donor to the credit card, it will match your donor account. So if it doesn't match, then your donor said, okay, then you have these contracts.
I think basically the chart of accounts is each account, the list, it's a list of accounts of the things that you want to track.
Right.
So if you want to track the food separate from everything else, then you'll want to make sure that you have an account for that.
Under okay. Probably
if you just want
food.
Your checkbook and you just want to keep your balance, then you can create an account to say things I spent money on.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter, you know, because it goes out of your checkbook and it went into things I spent money on,
yeah.
and that keeps it balanced, and you're done. Okay, but if you want to keep track of your food, your gas, and something else, then you'll want separate accounts for that, so that you can track those things as you go along.
Right.
And when it comes to budgeting, then you can say, I expect to spend $200 a month on gas. And so whenever you have a credit card bill that is for gas, then it takes it out of that 200. You can say, ooh, I'm getting close to my limit, you know, of what I expect to spend this month. And now budget's just planning what you think you're going to spend. And then, you know, you may allocate $100 a month for car repairs. So you don't spend that much every month. But then you can keep track of that. How am I doing this year? Have I spent my, you know, this is fifth month. Have I spent $500 on repairs this year? Ooh, no. Well, we're doing okay. So we're in our budget, and we're not going to go bankrupt.
The reason they have the current accounts outside of it is like, if you want to go get a loan and ask people for your balance sheet, you have to go back and you would have all your assets in there, all your cars you got in your house, you would have a problem with all that. You just wanted to keep up with your checkbook, like you say. As you say, checking account and all that's good. I just like that. No, you know, if I keep it simple, that's
like,
a big thing.
Does it remember, like, two power is the power bill?
Yeah.
Does it see that again? Will it remember and automatically put it there? And you have to do that manually all the time?
No. You start doing your budget, you start typing in.
Sometimes it did and sometimes it didn't. It doesn't always do that. I know, money does, and that I was a little bit disappointed. Sometimes it remembered and sometimes it didn't. And I'm not a power user yet. I can't tell you why it did or why it didn't. But I don't have a lot of transactions, so it's okay for me to just go through every month and say, the 20 or 30 things we spent money on, here's what they did. Here's where they went.
Mike, what I was going to add is it treats it just like an accounting system where your two credit sides or your left column are either going to be a cash or a revenue, and then your credit columns are either going to be an expense, a liability, or an equity. So your positive balances for your cash and your revenue are going to be a debit. Remainder are going to be a credit side.
What if it's a credit card account?
If it's a credit card, that's an expense. So that goes from credit.
You probably just had an accounting class, didn't you? You probably just took an accounting class, didn't you?
Sure. two of them, yeah.
Right. Right. So that's, I took an accounting class probably 15 years ago, so it's not so fresh in my mind. Did it make sense to you? I mean, you're an accountant.
No, it's very difficult for me because of the way I set up.
Yeah.
The
terminology needs to be consistent.
They can definitely improve.
Yeah.
I better agree with that. It's an excellent program, but it takes a rocket scientist almost to figure it out.
Patrick is welcome.
If, since we're throwing out alternatives, if you don't mind having your money or transactions out on a website, you can try mint.com. It's web-based. It'll work on.
Linux. Spell that.
Mint, like
U.S. Mint.
M-Y-N-G-T.
M-I-N-T.
Like my U.S. Mint.
Dot com.
Yep, mint.com. Mint. Like the U.S. Mint.
Spearmint. Yeah. Peppermint.
Mint.
Linux. It's in the cloud.
I mentioned it a while ago. But
did you say that a while ago?
No, I mentioned Money Dance, which I don't think I said it was cross-platform. It runs on Linux.
Yeah.
It does cost $29.
That's a Java program, isn't it?
Yes, Java, and you pay $29, and then it's free upgrades for life after that. I had the problem getting online banking working, and the main developer emailed me 4 or 5 times helping me through it. It's
nice.
Real good support. It's,
yeah.
You know, it's worth $29. I've been using it for 2 years.
Yeah.
And
I use it for my HOA, so it doesn't matter what the person has. You know,
yeah.
Just
right.
They, yeah. You know, use it as being Java based or whatever.
Money Dance is really simple. It's if you're used to using something like Quicken and you just get checking and saving, that's what I recommend.
We actually praise Jeff and John here. He's not here.
Right. He missed
it. It's okay. We're recording it.
Wherever he is, he probably went.
Bleep that out.
Well, thank you, Mike. We appreciate it.
Bye.
All righty. Well, I'd like to welcome everyone who's here for the first time. It's good to see so many new faces. This is my bride. She's Mrs. Chase. She's a new face here. I guess now, time for the news. Would you like to give us an update on the Upstate?
Yes, Mr. Yes.
Sure.
Upstate.
I'll even stand up for once. I think I just counted 26 people here. And how many of you are not registered for the Southeast Linux Fest? Raise your hand.
All those people with their hands raised, how many are going to self?
Well, you should.
Impossible. Everybody in this room must be there.
June 13th. You can make it.
June the 13th. It's a Saturday. And does anybody in here know the difference between a Linux Fest and a conference? A conference is something you go to, and when it's over, you go home. A Linux Fest is something that, when it's over, you stay there a little while. There's like a party after, and we're going to have two of those, one Friday night and one Saturday night. We're going to have 18 speakers. I'm really bad at names. Chris DeBona.
Wendy Seltzer.
Wendy Seltzer from the...
from Ocean City.
Yeah, we're going to have two distro community managers, or... project lead, Zach Tiles, and that's Paul Frills from Fedora, and Joe Zonker Brockmeyer from OpenSUSE.
Greg DeKonigsberg,
senior community architect for Red Hat, that's title. We're going
to
have a lot of people there.
They get to choose their own titles,
okay.
So it doesn't really matter.
Okay, ninja. We're going to have a lot of good speakers. We're about to fill up our expo hall. We can hold about 20 booths this year. But I've got my laptop set up over there, and if you want to go to the Southeast Linux Fest, registration is free, doesn't cost a dime. If you want to spend some dimes, you can spend $50 and become a supporter, and that will get you a T-shirt and the satisfaction of supporting the first-year Linux Fest in the Southeast in our backyard.
And some drink tickets.
Yeah. You forgot the important.
And drink tickets. The people who are registered as supporters will get is probably two free drinks to start with. We'll see where that goes from there. We've got a pre-party and an after-party before, you know, Friday and Saturday night.
I registered on the internet and said that I wanted to volunteer. I need to go back to the internet, to the website, and see what needs to be volunteered for? And I wrote and said, I don't know what needs to be done, so I can't say I'm good at cooking or I'll do new cash or whatever.
You need to talk to Kevin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Talk to Kevin. We need volunteers for things such as we're going to the Comfort Inn in Clemson is the official hotel of the Southeast Lane Fest. We've got a block of rooms, I think 40 or so to start with, available to us through May 30th at $70 a night. So if you want to stay there where the parties and stuff is going to be, you can make your reservations at Comfort Inn. But we'll need somebody there Friday night to maybe pre-register some people. We'll need somebody at the event early Saturday morning to register some people. We'll need people to pass out stuff. We need people to stuff the brochures in the bag. We're going to need a good double handful, 10 or 15 people, I would think.
Are you talking the day of or the day before?
Both.
Yes.
Both. Yes.
Before?
Yeah, we'll take you now too, but specifically.
I mean, seriously, if you want me to do something now, let me know and I'll start doing it.
Okay.
And we've got a couple of choice positions.
We do need to have, I think, a list of what is needed.
Well, first off, before we get further off topic, if you are going to stay at the Comfort Inn, you need to mention us to get a discount. And if you don't mention us, you won't get a room because they're running out of rooms in a hurry.
They've turned away some of our vendors already. But we've got a couple of choice positions on the Friday preceding and the Sunday following the event. We're bringing in virtually every speaker is flying in, and so we're going to have to make some runs to the airport and back. So if you want to sit in a van with someone, either from GSP or from Atlanta.
Charlotte, maybe.
Perhaps Charlotte. And, have the chance to bend some open source luminaries here for an hour or more. We can hook you up with that. You do have to drive a van for a while. You do have to be above 25 and, you know, have a driving record that doesn't cause them to want to charge us $5,000 to let you rent a car.
Well, I'm talking about transportation. I have a 12-passenger van that I'll be supposed to have you to move.
We'll definitely I'll send you an email probably tomorrow.
Thank you.
That's
Did you have a question?
I was going to make a suggestion for whoever's going to be doing the drive-in. Make sure you do not leave that van unless the person comes up to the van. I've worked at the airport.
Oh, yeah.
They will give you tickets.
Well, we've got so many people coming in and coming in from different places.
What I'm saying is, if nobody's there, do not leave that van unattended.
Yeah.
That's basically what we'll say, but they do not put up with it.
But as far as volunteer goes, if you just want to say, I'm available to help the day off, we'll find something for you to do because I'm sure there's something we've not thought of yet that needs to be done. That's all I got. See Kevin if you want to volunteer.
Stand up.
Well, Kevin, since you're standing up. I thought I saw something on the news about Freelinks PC, did I not? Or in the newspaper or whatever?
Charleston? Yeah. Yeah. So we have the first official, technology center in Charleston, which was put together by a number of groups, actually. Namely the Charleston, South Carolina Electric User Groups, yes. CSCLUG.org. A lot of really neat people out there. They hooked up with a gentleman from Clemson, and he got some computers from CDC, Center for Disease Control, and they partnered with the City of Charleston and the folks who run the Gussie Green Community Center, Chicory Community Center in South Carolina, in the Charleston area. So, and they set up about a 10 to 15 node lab at the community center there, calling the Gussie Green Technology Center. Basically, they're going to partner with Clemson and College of Charleston to offer classes that are actually starting this week. They're teaching basically all open source based curriculum. They're going to be teaching some basic web skills, open office. I think they're lining up kind of a curriculum they're going to start teaching folks in there. So the user group is kind of taking on their wing. They're going to be, you know, kind of helping the administrative staff there, you know, lay out a kind of a regular plan of teaching and get some job skills going. But the goal is basically to get people, you know, into a better paying job, kind of, you know, workforce development in that area. So it's got a lot of buzz. Down there, and they are now, we're now in the process of starting that in Columbia. So Shay is going to be heading that up, hopefully in Columbia, kind of helping get the form there. So,
and Freelinx PC is going to have a booth at Southeast Linux Fest.
That's the hope. Yeah, I got to find some volunteers to actually run the booth. So I need probably about two people to, you know, kind of hang out. And but yeah, if we haven't yet, Doug's going to do that. But we are going to have some pictures and videos, maybe of the Gussie Green Technology Center. We got a new website under development, freelinxbc.org. If anyone is interested in volunteering to help develop that, please let me know as well. It's all work there. So, come along.
Well, if you do have a booth at Southeast Linux Fest, will you be like taking donations?
Well,
for those who may be attending.
Yeah, well, the goal...
That was the webcast.
We can have a tax ID number for more.
Tax ID?
For Freelance PC already? You already got that set up?
Sure.
Okay, that's right, yeah. Well, we are going to be seeking nonprofit status, so the plus can help with that as well. But the goal with self is basically to have the website up and kind of get the idea out there and get the blogs involved in the concept of, you know, hey, here's an easy way to go out and create get the right people on board. If you want to know how to do it, you know, go to the website and learn, kind of see what we're doing. But yeah, I mean, as far as donations go, we will definitely accept, you know, people who want to, and obviously not going to bring them with them, you know, but we're in the upstate, so it's kind of a thing of, you know, it's more of a localized effort as far as donations. So, we'll work it out.
One more thing, Jason. I just want to remind people again that the laptop's over there, they want to register. It is free. It's only, you only need your credit card number if you want to give us $50. It's completely free. And this isn't just a South Carolina thing. This is a Southeast thing. We hope to have 500 people there. There's going to be free Wi-Fi at the event. There's going to be free Wi-Fi at the Comfort Inn. We're going to have three simultaneous tracks of speakers. There's something for everybody. If you don't want to listen to this speaker, there's two more you can listen to. And between the expo hall and the other, hopefully, 499 people that will be there beside you, there'll be somebody to talk to that you will enjoy.
Yeah, virtually the entire Slackware development team is showing up.
KDE guys.
KDE showing up. Stormy actually declined us, I think. I don't remember why. But we almost had the executive director for the GNOME Foundation. We've got some impressive speakers, and there are a lot of conferences.
We're going to have the Linux gaming industry there, right?
The entire Linux gaming industry is showing up. There's a lot of interesting things that we've had comments from several other conferences that essentially said, "How did you guys get such an awesome return on your call for papers? We haven't heard that much about it." And we're very happy, I think, for a first-year event, bringing in the kind of names that we're bringing.
We will have some free books as well. A Press is going to be offering.
There will be goodies and giveaways.
Yeah, Xenos is giving away a Dell Mini 12.
They're also giving away these little squishable zebras. They'll have lots of those. I'm sure everybody can get one of those.
Squishable things.
Okay, there has not really been a Linux, you should say Linux convention festival show. Gosh, and
six probably Ale in the late 90s.
Ale, yeah. The late 90s, yeah. Well, the last one, well, the one I went to was Ale in 1999, yeah. In fact. And then there was one in Raleigh, which, you know, Red Hat would be the biggest of. They were like in 2000, 2001, you know. That was the last time I heard. I mean, of course, you see it all over in Boston and New York and San Francisco and Las Vegas and all sorts of
stuff. If there's anybody who's particularly, say, artistically gifted, we have a need for creating large stencils for covert operations with spray chalk.
If you have a penchant for graffiti, we need you. Essentially, we're going to edit this from the podcast. We're going to litter the interstate and the highway with chalk. And the chalk is going to be a penguin with the word self right underneath it and a directional arrow so that you don't need your GPS. You just look for the penguin and you follow the penguin.
And this is to be on what, you say? The interstate?
The interstate.
Yes.
Might have a red screen being slightly in reality. Alright, well,
directional arrow.
Yeah. Follow the bloodshed.
That's really gonna do all that. Those long streaks, the red streaks, that's blood, doesn't mean red hat.
Yes, we're distro agnostic.
The mailing list today, I sent out the notification that we're having this today. Wes had said that he would be able to show. I've never forgotten.
That's okay. I'll tell you. In fact, I all of a sudden I have this weird little heckle here. So if I talk like this, it's just a headphone moment. So, no, you know, I'm doing a little bit of research. And, yes, I'm doing a little bit of research on YouTube. Nothing obscene or anything. But I'm pulling out some really cool old songs, blues songs. And that's really what I'm looking at. And I'm pulling these down. I was like, you know, this is great. Wow, this is fantastic. You know, we've got all this great stuff. And, you know, I'm learning, and this is really cool, and gosh, I wish I had this in some other format than MP4, because I really don't want to play it on my, I really can't play it on my MP3 players. So I was looking, I was researching. Now, this doesn't necessarily apply to things in YouTube, it's just a good example. And first of all, I would say, don't download anything copyrighted material, and don't trade and sell anything, because I don't, okay. Now, I have downloaded some good blues songs, some songs that some guys have worked on, and you'll see what I'm talking about in a second. But do be careful with that. But more importantly, if you ever wanted to take like a format, like an MP4, any of the other video formats, gosh, this is great, love the audio from it. You can always go online and do that. It just, sometimes it doesn't work. It gets a little bit out of tune. And I was looking at that because I want to play along with it, and well, I'm out of tune. So I knew there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a Linux way of doing it. And so I researched, and most of what I saw was using a couple of things. One of them was FFmpeg. Anybody ever use that? Yeah, FFmpeg. I did. Using FFmpeg is more or less can be conversion, can also be the libraries can be used, and we use it in a video surveillance solution to where we would be able to take in frames and use an in-player libraries and use FFmpeg libraries, be able to take and sample frames and then drop them into AVI format or DVI format or whatever you want to do. You know, you can be able to bring them in and drop them into those formats. And it's a great little conversion tool. This is what we're going to show you. So, y'all, please, sorry for what the content, if you're offended, my apologies. Nonetheless, it's the usage of the tools is really what I'm going to show here. Okay. So, to be real quick about it, yes, you can go and you can put this little thing in your little bar here, so it says get the videos. That said, for instance, this guy right here, and I'm kind of looking at a couple of things, cigars and cigar box guitars and blues especially. This guy has some really cool stuff on Delta Blues. His song was just, it was phenomenal. It was really just gritty. Just dirt. I mean, you're there in the Delta. You listen to the crickets are chirping on the porch, you know, and just it's really cool. So I said, gosh, wouldn't it be great? Download that, learn from it, listen to it. Perhaps Lightning Hopkins, right? Perhaps Blind Boy Fuller was another one that I was downloading. Okay, so this is great. So I'm going to do that. I'm not going to go through, because I already did the process a second ago. Pulls it down. Now, again, I'm not going to explain all that. That's not really the important part. But what is, and the cool thing, is the fact that once I've gotten them down, what am I going to do with them? Well, they're video, and like I said, I don't really want to be able to put them onto my MP3 player. First of all, they won't work. You know, I have to, believe it or not, it'll actually play video, but I have to convert it to Windows Media. And so it won't do the MP4s. But I do want to play the audio from it. So in my little directory here, MP4, and I've got one right above next to it. Oops. Correctly. I've got one with stuff in it. MP3, and that happens to be where I'm going to dump my MP3s at. You also see that I've got on there convert. Okay. Can you guys see this okay? I just want to make sure.
The purple does.
Sometimes
the,
you know, the screen
doesn't work.
Big pardon?
Turn the Jensen doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work.
But then you turn the lights down.
Green's okay.
Yeah, you know, it is what it is. There you go.
That's better.
Very good. Sometimes if you want me to enlarge this, I'll be more than happy to do that. So I have an MP4. So convert MP, or convert MP4.shell. Okay. I just like to call things .sh, so I'll know what they are. And if anyone has listened to Jace's treatments on the shell, right? This is a very simple one.
Does it involve Shakespeare or Bacon?
Yes, it does, actually. Hallelujah! It doesn't really do Bacon or Shakespeare or, I don't know, Einstein. But what it does do, it does pull in anything that has MP4 on it. Okay. Naturally, you can go in and you can script this any way you want. I can pull in just the files that I want to tell it to. Right? I can do my arguments that way. In this case, it just says just do them all. You know. And of course, I can also put in a remove, because naturally, I want to remove them once I'm done. Don't need the video. Right?
Need the audio.
I'm going to use this right here. Anyone, Jason, did you ever go through this or with base name?
I don't know what it is.
Okay. Well, what that does in basic, and you tell me different. Base name basically says, okay, to this argument here, you want to take everything in front of that, and that's the base name of this file. That's the name before you add it on whatever extension based on the argument you got there. So for I in however many .mp4s you have, this is a loop. This is a for loop. And you went through for loops, right? Or loops, right? Anyone miss out on that? You missed out on a lot. Anyone, Chase, you want to explain? Help us out. No, seriously.
You're doing a fantastic job.
Well, I'm not really that good, but nonetheless, hey, you learn from the best, right? That's it. So, base name, it goes through those, and it takes anything MP4, and it says, hey, look, I'm converting it, right? Because you want to know what it's doing, and you don't have to have all that. Now, the next one, FFmpeg, -AD, A is for audio, because you want to be able to pull the audio out, and B is the bitrate. Now, 192, and there's a website that goes into different bit rates. 256 is really, apparently, the ultra-high quality that you're really going to want to get. But they said 128 or 192 is very sufficient. There really wasn't that much of a difference between 128 and 256. So I settled with 192, and, of course, then the input file is naturally going to be that first file or that first argument in that loop. Okay. And then, of course, the output is whatever base name, because I want to name it the same thing, right? I don't want to have to type in the name all the time or have it clobber the other one. And, of course, it's going to run as .mp3 and done. And, of course, it's going to say, oh, yeah, everything was good. Okay. So let's start that. So what it's going to do, and while it's clearing this out, while it's actually just converting it, you're going to see up at the top, this is FFmpeg version. I guess you can say, be quiet, I don't want to hear all that. More importantly, it's going to say the input file, okay, of that song name or that video name. One thing that caught me as to why it didn't work to begin with. Now, first of all, I had to take the FFmpeg and compile it. Is anyone, who's not compiled software yet? Oh yeah. Now go ahead and raise your hand, because I'll tell you, when you first compile software, it's frustrating. It's absolutely frustrating. Gosh, what am I missing? I just can't understand this, right? But then you get a little bit used to it and you go, well, let's see. It says it stopped because of another format of the audio. Well, it said right there the audio was AAC, right? Anybody know what AAC is? I don't. I'm not an audio buff.
Advanced audio codec.
Say again?
Advanced audio codec?
Okay, right there. See, that's a codec. And so we know that, by the way, if you ever wanted to download FFmpeg or play around with it, which is really great to do, I suppose, and there's better ones, I'm sure. Correct me if I'm wrong, it's under mPlayer, right?
That's mncoder.
mncoder.
Yeah, mncoder is part of the mPlayer package. Right. It's like their own sort of FFmpeg thing. There's a third one called transcode, but it's mainly used for really high-quality video production.
Oh, really? That's neat.
It takes like four times longer than FFmpeg to do anything, but when I'm transcoding things out of MythTV, the quality's notably better with transcode.
Wow, it's like having high def versus regular analog TV. Nice. See, we used to use, oh, you're right, mncoder, that's right, because we were using that too. We were kind of a cross-library thing. So FFmpeg, and you download that, it goes to the compiler and complains, and everyone says, you can get binaries if you want. Really wasn't that bit, but it also did not have the codec support. And then also in this case, you'll see what my configuration was. Live FAAC, Live FAAB. What's FAAB? I never could figure out what the heck that was. It was some other libraries that we used. Also, Live MP3 Lane. Has anyone ever downloaded Audacity? Yeah, so you know you got to download the Lane libraries too, right? Okay, so I guess that's the support for the MP3, right? Because you can't export MP3 if you have that. Well, it's going to use those. Now, I tried also compiling Audacity and it complained bitterly, but whatever. And also, FFmpeg complained about not having the MP3 or the Lane libraries, okay? But it compiled nonetheless, went on through. And in this case, what we have here is to get back, we have our audio AC. That's what it was hanging up on to begin with. I said, well, you know what? Let me think. I ran into this before. So I knew that I had to have those libraries. I knew what FAAC was, right? And FAAD, we had to use those before. So let me try those. And I pulled them down and installed them, compiled them, installed them. They were RPMs. And it seemed to work. They work. We've had some great discussion, by the way, if everyone has not seen a great discussion on package management, right? And everyone has their arguments, but they worked. It worked great for me. But I installed them. And now, and with the Live 3 Lane, it converted. And now that I have my MP3, and there they are. Now, I get sound on this thing, but I still don't have anything really worth a darn that will play these. So I wish I could play them for you. Nonetheless, they converted. When I moved them over to my thumb drive, my Windows drive, they played beautifully. Not only that, and what was really important to me is that, because you go to these websites, just convert your YouTube video to an MP3 and they'll shoot you a little MP3 and everybody's happy, but it was off key. It was like a half a note too high.
What?
Yeah, it really was. It was strange. I'm like, that didn't sound right. I always have to go into Audacity and drop the pitch. They probably did.
Because I've done it in your writing.
Yeah.
They screw it up.
Yeah. So, right. And so I'm trying to play along with it. I'm going, this didn't sound right. So, but anyway, this works out great. Okay. Now, again, like I said, really the point here is don't go down to YouTube and download a bunch of copyright material. No. But if you ever have any MP4s or any other formats of video and you want to extract the audio, this is a great tool to do it with. Okay. And that is your FFmpeg.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I've got a little shell script that downloads the FL Lean version.
Really?
Yeah.
No kidding. Okay.
The way I understand it is the MP4 is embedded or wrapped inside the FL Lean.
Probably is, and FLV is your flash videos, right?
Yeah. So the flash video is just a wrapper of the MP4. Does anybody know if FFmpeg will go inside the FLV?
Well, let's look for that. How about that? This is what I did. Hey, everyone else, right?
Yes. In fact, you can, if you notice, if you ever like view top while you're watching back a flash video, your CPU is like really high. But if you download the FLV and then play it back with the mPlayer, it's like your system's almost completely idle. mPlayer is like just ignoring the flash file completely, just plug the media within it.
Okay.
And there's, in most distro repositories, there's a Perl script called YouTube-DL, which does that, and you feed it the URL, and it cans out the FLV for you.
Wow.
Garcia, Ricardo, something.
So I guess using, and I'm going to say it like this, I think this would be, and I never tried, that's really good.
Oh, there it is.
Right there. I have no idea what the A and R are. Well, the A would be the audio, I'm sure. Input file would be, you know, dash I would be the input file. AR, I don't know what the R is. I mean, one could find out. Do the, you know, man, FFmpeg. Now, I did the compile. Doofus me didn't put the man pages in the right spot, so it doesn't show up. I don't care about that. But anyway, so FLVs. Now, I've done a little bit of flash scripting, so, you know, pop in an MP3 or pop in some kind of audio. I do know that it gets embedded into the Swift files, and I think it would probably be the same thing as the FLVs. Okay.
You mentioned earlier that you didn't have any really quality gains after, like, 128 kilobit. The standard flash quality is, like, 80 or 96 kilobit, but if on YouTube there's a high quality link and the video does have high quality, that is encoded at a higher quality, but the YouTube download script will only get it standard. So what you have to do is get Firefox and get the video downloader extension for Firefox, play it in high quality, and then video downloader will see the high quality FLV. Then you can download it, then you can kick out your actual decent quality audio file.
See, that's really interesting, and I'll tell you why. Just for grins and giggles, and I don't know what difference this makes. Okay. First of all, now, you know, down here, oh, I don't want to cut that off. I don't really want to play
it. Yeah, normally there should be the high quality button right there.
However, do you know how to get it high quality when you don't have high quality? I love this. This is before, this is high quality before we had high quality. Oh, I love that. FMT equals 18. I love that. Now, I don't know if this is actually going to do anything with this one. It all depends on how they upload it. You know,
if it's too old and they haven't gotten to it yet, it's
right.
Yeah.
Chicken salad, right? Okay. So, but let's see what this does.
You just tag it on
a little bit better. Tag it right at the end of the URL. FMT equals 18. Okay. Now, you also notice what happened there.
Did your
URL over on the right down, did it change code? That URL.
It's right here?
No. Down.
No.
Way down, right?
Down. That thing right there. Compare it to the non-high quality. See if that actually changed.
Well, what we can do.
That's on the, just above the embed. For our listeners at home.
You're already right. I see. I don't know if it changed. Right above the embedded, right? I don't know.
And take out the FMC and see if that changed.
I'm pretty sure it's slightly different.
Well, you can definitely tell a difference here. I mean, you know, see a little. Well, I don't know if you can see it on
that's
there.
A red dot, man.
To me, it's a little fun. Yeah, red dot. The origin. Okay, let's see if we can get a little bit better quality. Let's see, that's what I'm looking at. This guy's really good on what he does. Let's see if we can get this text a little bit better. Yeah, you can see a little bit more definite. Guys, first time I saw this, I'm like, oh, it's a regular video. Bam. It was like looking at high-definition TV. See, a little bit better definition. So if y'all ever want to, you know, it doesn't have the HQ button. What do I do? So what you're saying is, if it comes down in high quality, the sound may be better?
It's encoded at a higher quality. Really? If you get the high-quality version of the YouTube, it's encoded at 128 kilobit.
Theoretically, this would be, we would hope. Therefore, if I were to do
deep within YouTube's data centers, they have everything you upload. They don't just get rid of it after they transcode it to an FLV. They keep it so when they upgrade quality, they run through everybody again and dump the new FLVs.
And some of them you go to, it's already high quality. Some of them you have
to
have a button. Some of them you don't, but you have to know the little code thing. Yeah. And simply right there, the little piece of JavaScripting, which is, hey, save the file. That's all it does. So there you go. So I've been doing that. I've been doing the high quality, pulling it down, saving it, and then listening to it. So this guy, like I said, this guy was incredible. And you see his little home video.
That sounds great.
You're right. I'm looking at it.
Well, I can turn it. Actually, I can turn it on.
You got it on mute.
There you go. Can't really hear it that well. I can't hear it that well.
That was awesome.
So anyway, point being is, like I said, you want to convert your videos, you want to convert your MP4s or whatever other formats, FFmpeg or other tools, right? Does it, makes it great.
Will Audacity do this directly?
Not to my knowledge. In fact, I've tried opening up MP4s, nada.
There's a program called WinFF that is more or less a graphical front end for most of these conversions that FFmpeg will do. You can choose input-output formats from a drop-down list. I mean, it's...
What is that called?
WinFF?
WinFF. FF is the
cross-site? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure it would be like FFmpeg or... And there's also an FFmpeg player, if I'm not mistaken. There's like something. Gosh. We had a... And it came out with FFmpeg, but it was for Windows. And it really was to be able to play the video surveillance. I was working on this video surveillance package. That's another little Linux thing I was doing. That we would pull that down to be able to play the video files, the AVIs that it would create, so that you can go back and review them. But it was just a simple player, so.
I
have a question.
Yeah.
Just trying to get something onto YouTube. Is it not like MPG files, apparently?
I wish I had. You know, the funny thing about it is I go to YouTube to do this kind of research, but I never uploaded anything.
You can upload multiple formats to YouTube.
I'm sure you could. I mean, you know. I'm not a, you know, YouTube is one of those nice double-edged swords. It's really fun to look at stuff, and but you can get quite addicted to it. It's like Facebook or MySpace, but then you can also see some really nasty stuff.
Something else you may want to look into. I've only seen one video like this, but YouTube does have HD out support, so see if some of yours have HD quality, because that will be an even higher audio code.
You mean what? Sorry.
On YouTube, there's regular, there's high quality. There's also HD. If there's anything that was uploaded to it in high enough quality.
You can watch it.
But I've only seen one video ever on YouTube that's been HD capable.
There was one on here that I saw. As you see, I got a lot of... Why do I have a lot of guitar stuff? I have a lot of it. There was one on here, I think I deleted it. And it was one of the first ones I saw in high def. It was actually a clip from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It was a short clip when they were in the museum. It was unbelievable. It was like looking at high definition TV, only this big. But it was absolutely super. But anyway.
If you have a PS3, you can go to youtube.com/TV.
Uh-huh.
And you can do it on PC as well.
Really?
The,
oh, hey, look at there.
Format. Yeah, when you're at YouTube, search for Sydney Fireworks 2009, and that's the HD version. Don't bother to play it back. You don't have a serious processor and graphics card, though.
Oh, it'll melt this thing right now.
Probably.
Well, there you go. I'm done. Thank you.
And now we have Rick giving us a short point.
You need this, don't you?
Okay. Yeah, I can do it. That's right.
Yeah, sure. What do you need
on Android?
Just like there's a presentation.
Yeah, go ahead. I'll show you. I mean, just done the latest with Aura?
Nope.
It's really cool.
Here.
So, Android.
Android.
This is like data. Enterprise, right?
It's... No.
No?
It is...
Yeah, you got it. Oh, yeah, it should be. Hopefully it'll be there. Yeah. Okay. Oh, it's like VR Office. Isn't that weird? It's like, apparently there's a branded version, a non-branded version of Open Office for Fedora.
Like an ice weasel kind of thing, I guess.
I don't know. Is it good?
Okay. Well, I have to apologize. I haven't done any lousy presentations in, what, about 3 or 4 years? But they're usually pretty incomplete, and pretty unprepared, and I haven't failed again. I'm pretty much unprepared. But anyway, this shows that I did at least start the effort. And anyway, we're always looking for things that are running on Linux. Everybody's, you know, we use our desktops and our laptops. And one of the areas that I think is pretty strong in spite of the economy is mobile devices. And if you've looked into developing applications on mobile devices, you'll find a lot of it is proprietary. A lot of the development tools only run on Windows. And when I heard about Android, which is got started by Google, and there's a consortium, group of people, companies, that got together, about 30 of them, and they formed this alliance to develop this open source mobile platform. The thing that's of interest to Linux people is that it runs on a Linux kernel. Right now, I think there's only, what is it, the G1?
Yeah.
Mobile device that it's actually being sold on. But what they're doing is they're getting development tools going and doing a lot to make it available to developers. One thing with the applications, if you notice, like iPhone, they're kind of restrictive about what applications they'll allow you to sell and what, you know, they've banned some, and there's been stories about, you know, baby bashing apps that they wouldn't let go out to the public and things like that. But not that they're going to have baby-bashing Android applications, but it's not as constricted. You know, they're more open, and it's the kind of thing where if you want to get into it, one of the development tools, they really do run on Linux. I have it set up at home, and I probably should have just brought my desktop in and show you the emulator and all that good stuff and how to set it up on NetBeans. It runs the IDE for Eclipse, has a plug-in for it. So. And of course, they run on Linux. Funny thing with things like NetBeans running on a Linux machine is that when you download the mobile development tools, go to run it, it says, oh, you need a .exe file in order to actually develop and have an emulator that works. So the nice thing here is that you've got the emulator that does run on Linux. The device itself uses Linux as the kernel. And so it's an open source software platform, mobile devices, and it's Open Handset Alliance is the group that's behind it with Google. And it runs on Linux ARM, and I have a little bit more about that a little bit later on. And there's two ways that you can write applications for Android. One is that you can write them in Java, and that's what most of the applications that come with it are written in. But you can also write like the core applications in C, and it uses GCC for the compiler. Now, since you've got Linux OS and software, they have two licenses for it. One is primarily for the GPL, for the Linux operating system. And then the second one is the Apache software license for the platform itself minus Linux. So it's kind of a unique licensing situation there. Now, one thing that that I think is kind of neat is that they've gone out and they're using some pretty good, solid technology, things that are used on other places, like the WebKit browser that's used on the Mac for Safari and iPhone. So you'll have a lot of support in that area. The database that they support is SQLite. I don't know if anybody's heard of it, but it's also the default database for Ruby on Rails. You're familiar with that.
Everybody should have heard of it. We had a presentation on it.
Okay, good. And it's been presented here. So, and then the graphics support is good. Audio support. And then, of course, we have SSL from Apache. Now, this is a little bit more about the C application development. It's using the Sorcery G++ Lite Edition for ARM. And the ARM platform is a 32-bit RISC processor. If anybody knows what RISC stands for, I forget.
Reduced Instruction Set.
Thank you. Very good. The GCC compiler, in case you were wondering, is ARM None Linux GNU EAVI GCC. And the linker, can you read that? And now here is your Hello World application in C for Android. file. Unfortunately, I can't.
How much?
Now, the kicker, because of the static compile and linking, it's 568,231 bytes just for that hello Android. So,
wow.
Yeah. So, not too good for mobile devices. But anyway. Now that
you should you don't have to have it set, do you?
No. Okay. That was just something I was reading about that okay. said that. So, but anyway, for the most part, application development is going to be in Java. And why do they do that? Well, Java is that's actually on the next page. But anyway, the virtual machine that they use is the Dalvik virtual machine, and employs services on the Linux kernel. Provide a rich environment for Android applications. And of course, the primary language, since it is a JVM, is Java.
Android itself is not operating system. It has to have Linux,
it's,
a Linux kernel.
Right. It's a platform that sits on top of Linux, and Linux provides various services that it needs. And it's Android is more like a framework that sits on top, and then, of course, they're using the Hold on.
Did it crash on you?
No, I just I was hitting it too fast.
I think PageF will get to the previous slide.
Oh, is it? Okay. Let's just...
And if I'm correct, that the JVM has embedded hooks within the kernel, then? Is that...
Well, it's like any virtual machine. The idea is that you have a common development environment, the Java language, and then the virtual machine itself takes care of the operating system that it sits on, so that you don't have the portability issues with trying to develop C applications on multiple platforms, and there was problems with the size of integers and different
things. Well, normally you have a JVM, it's running in like user space or something. Did I understand that this Dalvik VM is more closely tied into the kernel?
It's really not. No. In general concept, it's not much different than any VM that runs on any operating system.
Okay.
It's the idea, right? Once run anywhere, kind of deal. Okay. It is good for Linux developers because of all the tools that are available that do run on Linux. And there is support for Eclipse and NetBeans, although I couldn't get the NetBeans thing to install. It kept timing out on me, so I think I just had a network problem.
Now, what's the purpose of the virtual layer? I mean, you could write this for Android and run on any other platform.
Well, for another platform idea, let's say you've got the mobile device, Linux running on a mobile device. What they're working on right now, with netbooks being so hot, that Google is coming out with Android running on a netbook. So what you're going to have there is you'll have a virtual machine for the Java applications, and there's a certain structure that an Android application goes through. There are certain events that take place in the life cycle of an application, and it pretty much is controlled by Android. You don't have control in your program. So you can't say when it starts, when it stops, when it pauses. Those are things that, a person using the device, they can start an application, and that is an event that you do certain things, initialization, stuff like that. Well, they can also switch to another application, well, that's going to pause your application. Then there's also the limited memory in a mobile device. So the platform is going to control whether or not your application gets killed because of resources, or if it keeps it in the background. And you don't know, as from a programmer standpoint, when and where these things are going to happen. So there are different events that are available within your within the API, and there are certain things that you should do at different points. Like if it pauses, you should, if you want to save the state of where your application is, that's the time to do it, because you don't know if it's going to get to the kill event where you might want to do that, because it might just decide that it's going to kill your application and it never goes back into your application.
If you're paused, you're paused.
Well, if you're paused, but you see, you can have kill within your program. Like you can say, okay, somebody can have, you can program it to have a button that turns the program off. But the platform can decide to kill it and never goes back into your program. So it's structured in a kind of a different way. So you wouldn't really have just your regular, typical Java application that would run on Android. It has to follow a certain structure. But I'm sure when they get to the netbook, which isn't, you know, it's obviously not the same as a mobile environment, there'll be differences in the API. And I think that's part of what they're working on, just to get to that point.
That's a couple months out, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's an ARM processor?
Well, there is one that's out right now, and I read a little write-up on it. They said it's very limited, battery life is horrible, it's a fairly weak machine, but it was the
prototype,
and it was a start. Now, another thing that I found out that I think is kind of neat, with Java being primarily the only language that Android or that Google has available for it, I found out that there's also a company that's put together a Ruby framework to run on Android, BlackBerry, iPhone, Symbian, some other platform. But anyway, it does. There are new frameworks coming out, so I wouldn't be surprised if you find a Python framework that comes out at some point that it becomes a pretty popular.
You know, is this JVM limited in that it won't run JRuby, Jython, Scala?
The JRuby guys are playing around with it.
Okay, so it's not those.
It's not important. They said that they're, you know, they've looked at the platform and the API, and they said that they think they can get. They've had some people working on doing that, so. But one of the things that I got a kick out of with this Row Mobile is that the applications are written in HTML and Ruby. HTML for the interface. So it takes your HTML page and generates the screens for you. I mean, it's kind of bizarre. I haven't played with it yet, and I kind of want to just get in there and fool around with it. But well, the next step would be to look at the emulator, and I apologize that I have some problems getting that going. But maybe another meeting I'll have it all working and maybe have some real applications to show you.
Well, regarding battery life, that should be improving. T-Mobile will push 1.5 to G1 soon. It's supposed to be a 25% to 33% gain in battery life. If you have an unlocked or a dev phone, you can already get it.
It's already pushing out to customers. People in Texas were reporting it as of last night.
Wow. This definitely don't have it yet.
Yeah, my wife doesn't either. I sat there looking at it last night.
Come on, come on!
That's it.
Any other questions?
So, currently Google is pitching Android for OLPC. And I don't know where that stands, if that's going to happen or not. But it's an interesting application.
Because I've also seen an article in GE Times where this consortium is pushing it not only for netbooks, but VoIP phones and karaoke machines.
Really?
another
Linux. And that probably wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for Linux. Linux runs on just about everything. So all they have to do is tweak their VM so that Android works on top of it.
Thank you.
Rick, why would someone run Android? Weird question. Why would you run Android as opposed to just putting the Java virtual machine and writing it in Java? Am I missing something?
Well, and I probably should have covered some of that. What I think part of the advantage is that the different things that are available just on the basic Android platform, the applications and the different services, and what you can do with Android that's probably harder to do with other just plain Java is that it has some real nice tie-ins with the Google mapping kind of stuff. GPS is available, and there's a lot to tie all that together, so it's a lot easier to pull that into your application.
Is Android providing the screen services? In other words, it's not running X Windows. It's got a different display technology.
Yeah, it's probably something along the lines of a Swing kind of.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess that you don't have X Windows per se, which is fairly heavy for a mobile device.
Yeah.
But they're providing their own display drivers. And that's part of what would come in the virtual machine. If you run a Java virtual machine on Linux, it's going to expect to have X Windows there to provide the display, which for a mobile device would be a lot heavier.
Well, it sounds like if you can write stuff in HTML and it shows up on the screen, then WebKit must be in some ways related to being the X11 replacement or something. That's my supposition.
WebKit for the browser type of functionality. And there's just grab one of the articles on it or go out and look at some of the documentation, just the different things that they're trying to make available on it.
I think I read somewhere too that it kind of boils down to this ARM processor and even further down to eventually the system on a chip.
Mm-hmm.
And these ARM processor netbooks, the price point is going to be like $150.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? $150.
And if they're really, really low
power
requirements.
Yep.
There's some impressive ARM stuff out there. There was a vendor at Scale that had a booth pretty close to us, and they had essentially single board, just a few chips on the board, ARM boxes that were capable of doing 27, 28 frames a second. And that's pretty impressive out of something that doesn't have a heat sink, doesn't have a dedicated video chip.
So what does ARM stand for?
I believe it's Advanced Risk Microprocessor.
That's more recent than RISC, right?
Is that what it is?
Everybody pause around my mouth for a minute, please. Okay, so
first you got to do what you did at Costco.
That scared me.
What did I do?
Dude, that was wrong.
What'd you throw your laptop for?
I didn't get the reaction there.
You freaked out everybody behind. Look at this.
This is carpet.
It's messed up now.
My display's messed up. I've thrown this thing like 70 times. I've thrown it on concrete. And I have never had my...
You gave it a missile dodge at an angle on
carpet.
Finally good.
Actually, it's me inside the silence. Consuming.
Did I have that one?
So, one of the things that has happened, OLPC ran Give One, Get One again this year. And it was not successful. They're kind of a victim of their own success. There weren't, 2 years ago, or two Christmases ago, there were not a lot of netbooks pervading the market, unless you consider the very expensive Toshiba Libretto and things like that. What they essentially did, they were planning on selling a lot, and they did not. More than an order of magnitude difference in what they expected and what they actually sold. And as a result, they laid off a lot of their engineering staff. One of the things they had done ahead of time was to essentially split the software and the hardware divisions. And so the software is Sugar Labs, which runs on top of Fedora, which is why I'm involved in it. So Fedora has taken over the North American developer thing. We've taken over the program whereby you can get an XO.
Throw it again, it might come back.
It might. I'm going to do that in a minute.
Hit it like a TV.
So, essentially, what we're looking for is people who, A, know Python, are willing to learn Python, and by August, churn out a fourth grade math activity. So, essentially, we're taking the state of Massachusetts fourth grade math curriculum, and we are writing small software applications that teach that curriculum. So we've got one application that, for instance, is a role-playing game. And you come up and you fight these monsters, except to win against the monsters, you have to demonstrate some knowledge of basic math. And, I mean, we're not even talking algebra at this point. And you advance in the game by continuing to answer questions. There's a number of others. We've got five students at Clemson. The Rochester Institute of Technology has a 25-student class that in game design that's doing nothing but working on activities. We've got a group in Utah.
Activities?
Well, in Sugar, applications are referred to as activities instead of programs or applications because it's about doing something, not about how it works. So if you're interested in that, I received a pallet of these.
That's where you're throwing them on the floor.
So, generally, I throw them on the floor to show how robust they are. It just failed this time.
That feels great.
Okay, now I really get to have that.
Yeah, we'll work on it.
Reboot? Yeah, reboot it.
So, anyway, if you're interested in that and either want to learn Python or already know Python, well, you can get a what is generally a very rugged, and it's really taken a lot of abuse from me, machine for free, and get involved in some open source software development. If you're interested, let me know.
It's got to be a math app.
Yes, it is fourth grade math. That is the curriculum we're targeting right now.
You can come up with a concept on your own and whatever, if there's a guideline?
There's not a whole lot of guidelines as long as you're willing to just jump in and do it and get it done.
But you have the fourth grade math, don't you?
No, because essentially there's no textbooks, fourth grade math textbooks, that are freely redistributable, which is one of the problems that we're coming up with. We've got South Carolina has 50,000 of these going to some of the challenged schools, most of them on the corridor of shame. But they can't distribute content with them, even if the state paid for them, because the XOs make sharing so easy. As a matter of fact, if I had a book open and I wanted to show you what page I was on, there's two buttons to click and you get to see what I'm seeing. And I'm essentially sharing the entire document. So since there's no open content, we're essentially writing some of that content, although not necessarily all textbook.
You can't use anything like TuxMath?
You can, but TuxMath doesn't map very well to a specific curriculum. And so we went and grabbed a curriculum that was freely redistributable. And we're building small applications to teach each of those objectives, essentially.
Yeah, California is going to open source all their
textbooks. They're in the process of trying to do that, yeah. And that will be a huge win, because right now your options are essentially Wikibooks or something that's really, really old, which doesn't work for a lot of subjects now.
I wonder how they're doing that with publishing companies, though.
What's the math publishing company?
They will be their own publishing company.
Same
because no publishing company wants to.
Well, publishing companies, I mean, if they print your book, they hold, or, you know, you're leasing them the copyright. But you can go to a publishing company and say, here's my content, I want you to print a book. It's just going to cost you a lot because they're not going to make, you know, they don't make as much money off of it. So if the state of California develops the text, they can go to any publishing company and say, here's what we want printed, and here's what we want to pay for it.
I think it's Rusty eBooks they're shooting for. I don't think they're about
it. Could be. It could be.
Yeah.
Is it a Creative Commons license? I mean, that lends itself more to
the public domain.
Public domain.
Yeah. Because most states can't publish copyrighted material in the first place. That's one of the reasons we went with the state of Boston. It's all public domain because.
Massachusetts.
Yeah. There is no state of Boston. That may be the only thing in Massachusetts, but
I've been to the country of Asia, so that's all right.
I've been to the land of it.
We normally tend to go to Indiegogo's afterwards. You're all welcome to come. It's on which road?
Picture somewhere.
And he's using his credit card. Are you going somewhere different?
Yeah.
Does anyone else want to go somewhere different?
Sure.
Who's
going to
go?
First one. I'm starving.
Nobody can leave until they register for the Southeast Linux Fest.
Oh, yeah. I'm
leaving
for the beach
Saturday.
Thank
you.
No.
Thank you for a bunch.
Nice
to see y'all. Come back again.
No, I think you've got your priorities wrong.
I know I do.
Please.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net. So head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.